This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Autistic people can't usually describe how they feel. This makes it very difficult for others to understand the autistic world. That's what makes Donna Williams' autobiography so unusual and so valuable. After being labeled deaf, retarded, disturbed, and insane, Williams wrote the story of her life when she was in her mid-20s. She gave it to a child psychiatrist, hoping he would read it and tell her what was wrong with her. He sent it to a specialist in autism and passed on a copy to a publisher. It's just been published by Times Books. Williams was born in Australia in 1963. Her mother didn't understand Donna's condition. She was ashamed of her daughter and abused her. Donna Williams left home at the age of 15 to get away from her family and managed to find work and live on her own. Autism is believed to be caused by a neurological dysfunction. Autistic people find it hard to process information, everything from language to facial expressions, touch, and other human cues we take for granted. They also find it difficult to adjust to change and to anything new. Before my interview with Williams, her representative at Times Books suggested I send Williams my questions in advance so she could interpret them and think about them. I also spoke with Williams on the phone before the interview so she could get accustomed to my voice. She warned that if I asked the questions out of sequence, she would lose me, but if I told her the number of the question I was skipping ahead to, she could probably follow along. She brought a portable computer into the studio with her to write down any new questions I asked, and she told me it's easier for her to write than speak.
The first thing of that I want to say is that when you talk about writing, there's a difference between handwriting and typing. Typing is less time-consuming, so the awareness of the amount of effort that you put into self-expression, it causes, with handwriting, a greater degree of shutdown. When I'm typing, my thinking flows better and the retrieval of words is easier. It's a lot easier than speaking because there's also less emotional overload and less direct social involvement. With typing, what happens is as I'm thinking, I'm spelling out the words that go to the pictures in my head, and it always involves exactly the same action, which is just the hitting of a key, which is different to the writing of letters with handwriting. And so there's no battle informing anything as it comes out, and so the speed of expression is quick enough to get out without any blockages. If I... when I type, I hit the keys, but for me, my conscious awareness doesn't process it as self-expression. It doesn't get enough time. It just says, I'm hitting keys. It's the keys that are talking to the page. And because of this, I'm often not aware that I'm thinking at all until it appears on the screen in front of me. So it kind of bypasses the conscious processing, which is much, much harder with speech and involves a lot more mechanics with speech and more awareness of emotions and having a self and other at the same time. Also, for me, 1 hour's writing is the same equivalent as perhaps 1 hour of your talking, but 1 hour of my talking is like about 1 hour of my talking is like if you were talking for about 5 hours. It's like going through a fight, and every word is like dragging the words out of the mud.
Donna, this will be question number 4. When you were a child, you used to dream about spots of color. Were those spots of color in your waking world also?
When I rubbed my eyes, yes. When you rub your eyes and you look at the light, you can see those spots. Anybody can. But I suppose for me, they were more intense. They still are more intense now. The slight variations in colour on something to someone else can strike me very strongly. The other thing that there was little sparkles everywhere in the air and like whooshing round. And what they actually are charged energy particles that are dancing and whooshing around on the airwaves. And that's caused by having very hypersensitive vision. And I understand that some of that is related to the fact that meaning is not being processed. So these things are like the foreground and everything else is so irrelevant. For me also, I think that, in fact, it was so enclosing. It made me feel part of all this dancing light is very, for me, was a very beautiful thing. But I do think also that the ability to focus so totally in such a single way is because of a lack of sensory integration. Otherwise, I'm sure I would have been putting all sorts of incoming things together instead of being so highly focused on little charged energy particles.
Do you think that you still see or hear things that other people don't?
I think that I see color and reflection far more intensely than other people. I don't think I see anything that's not there. I just see things that take other people a much greater degree of focus, and the things that are usually background information for them that they've began overlooking years and years ago is still often I have to fight to not make it foreground. And what's more is the response I have to this. For me, it gives me a very intense emotional and physical response, and other people hardly respond at all, let alone be captured or very moved by those kind of things.
Sometimes you test to see if someone is real. How do you test?
I found this a very strange question. I didn't really understand this question. I'll say what I think, though. I think that sometimes people aren't real because they're being superficial and they're so tied up with doing and saying what they don't mean. There's nothing genuine about them. Sometimes I will sense people. It's a kind of, I call it their life music. And sometimes you can tell that it's not in line. Everything they're doing is not in line with what you sense of who they are. I can't understand who they are, but I can sense who they are. And it's like they kind of feel dead, like they haven't got a self, like their whole repertoire is who they think they are. I think that's when I was also about 13 was the first time that I realized that people were not exactly meaning everything they said and did. And when that realization hit me, I didn't have the language to explain. I walked around saying, everybody's plastic, and hitting myself because I was trying to say they're superficial. They're not meaning what they're saying. My disappointment in the possibility of a predictable world or a world of guarantees was really shattered when I realized that people were not real in that sense. Can you understand me?
Yes, yes. Mm. What else frightens you or makes you uncomfortable about other people?
One thing I think is, again, to do with touch. With me is probably emotions and touch are the most difficult. Some of that comes to do with body awareness. And what happens, for example, is I have just recently learned that when people touch one part of themselves to another, they feel it in both. I learned this when I said to somebody, I was very shocked that my leg had told my hand where it was, because over the years, only my hands told my leg where it was. You understand? Not that the other way.
Right.
And that progressed to one day, they both felt it, and I just was really shocked. I thought something had gone very wrong, and this made a lot of sense to me to why things like touch were so difficult for me to interpret, even from a physical perception point, let alone closeness and the social connotations, everything, and the fact that my perception of my body is in bits. There's other things such as the self and other problem, which means that it's hard to work out who's doing what to whom, who's doing the wanting, who's doing the accepting. It's not all working for me. there's not a lot of interpretation of physical sensation. There's either my eyes are turned on here and I can see it coming, or there's the physical interpretation, or there's some emotions but no physical interpretation. It's all very mono. Other things like touch hypersensitivity make it very frightening, because it can send me through the roof. Even having someone walk past me, if my touch is very hyper at that time, it's like even touching myself is a torture. And it feels like if it goes higher than that, it's like overload. And if it goes into shutdown, I end up feeling as dead as the table. If I hit the table and I hit myself, I can tell the difference by the texture of the object that I'm hitting. But the inner sensation, forget it. So the interpretation inside is anger and betrayal, because it feels like the other person has killed you off. And when they think this is closeness, or this is love, or they then want you to say, oh yeah, that was great, and I really like you too, it is so alienating and really frightening that how different they are. Or if you say, no, they're not different, they're the same, which is often what they tell you, then you think, they must be crazy. Why do they do this if they're the same, if this is their perception? Also, it's very hard sometimes to get all the mechanics going to say, I don't want this. First, you've got to interpret a not want. And to do that, you've got to be able to read your own body messages. So it means I'm very vulnerable in company of other people. When those people think they like me or something, you're much safer with people who don't give a damn.
What are some of the things or some of the activities that give you the greatest pleasure?
I don't know how silly this will sound. Crystal chandeliers. Pink streetlights. What else? I like the ocean at the night time. I get very excited about the ocean of the night. I think also being with people who can communicate with me in my own way, with no struggle.
My guest is Donna Williams. She's an autistic woman who has just written her autobiography called Nobody Nowhere. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donna Williams, the author of Nobody Nowhere, the autobiography of an autistic. Where do you live now?
I live outside of London in a village.
Do you live with someone?
No. I have a friend who comes and stays sometimes. It's good because we're like brother and sister, and neither of us, we don't have, because we're the same, we are like each other. In that he also has the same kind of difficulties as me. So there's no expectation of what do you feel for me, or, and there's no interest to touch each other, or even we don't interpret the shape of each other. We are just, that's what we look like and that's that, and there's nothing else. There's no attraction, there's no nothing. So there's no fear that anyone's going to exploit anyone or look for things that aren't there or wish that they were there or take the other person's response or lack of it as a reflection on them. You understand?
Yes.
So it's good, really good.
Do you know many other autistic people?
I know quite a lot of autistic people because, for one thing, because of the book, but also through a couple of networks that link up autistic people with one another. The people I've met are all very different from each other. I share some things in common with some and some different things in common with others. My best friend is somebody I share most things of my system in common with, even though our interests may be different sometimes. But generally, they're more easy to communicate with. Most of them I communicate with by writing. But what makes it easy for us to communicate with each other are things like having a shared system, sometimes shared interest, especially shared past experiences of family relationships, schools and jobs, shared physical responses or the lack of them, and that shared incongruity with the system values and definitions of non-autistic people, like with things like closeness or touch or sexuality or communication. And also non-autistic people may find us interesting, but it's usually some idea of we're either special good or we're special bad. But with each other, with one autistic person with another, we are generally much more accepted as we are. I have a saying which I think for me captures that, and that is that normal is to be in the company of somebody else like yourself. And when we're with each other, we feel normal.
I understand. I think, yeah. Donna, would it be okay if I asked you some questions that were not on the list now?
Well, you can ask me them and I'll see if I can work out what I think or understand.
Okay. You've referred to a state of total shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe what it feels like to be in that state of shutdown?
Hold on. I'm holding on to your question here. What does shutdown feel like?
Yes.
I describe that because for me, many things are very single track. It's like everything is on a scale. And if you imagine that scale is from 0 to 5, then most people's highest point is 3. So if they feel emotions, for example, their most extreme emotions are 3. After that, your body starts to shake. After that, you can't process the meaning of what's happening to you. After that, it's like going slowly into a state of shock, and that's what happens for me. But the kind of experiences that give other people a sense of 3 can give me a sense of 5, which means that the physical response looks like having a fit. Every part of my body will be in tremors. It feels painful to feel that emotion. And then the only way over that is a complete, like, it's like walls go up. It's like going into a state of shock, and next thing, there is no meaning, but at least all the pain's gone. You feel dead. But for me, this happens also with my vision. It happens with touch. It happens with hearing. So when the meaning drops out of vision, first I'm very affected by what I'm seeing. Then next thing I notice, I have no interpretation of the colour, shape, pattern of what I'm seeing. There's no putting together with what it means, what to do with it, anything, until it is so frightening. It's like being meaning blind. And meaning deaf is the same, so all the words in the world can't help me. Nothing is familiar. You say a word to me, cup, I won't know what it means. It's just a sound. It's a series of sounds, and I'll keep trying and trying to put it together, and I can't. But what leads to that is this feeling of sounds being so heightened that they tickle me. They can be very exciting. And then next thing, the meaning is slowly dropping out until there's none there. If you get all those kinds of shutdown together, including the retrieval of words for language, you're in big trouble. It feels like hell. It feels like death. And you're just totally terrified. It's like being buried alive.
When was the last time that happened to you?
Maybe... Oh, I know, 1 week ago, and my friend was with me, and he helped bring me back with my sense of smell and rhythm. I couldn't make sense of who he was or what he meant to me. All I knew was that the visual impression of this person before me was familiar, and that the sound of his voice was familiar, even if I couldn't comprehend. And then he had me smell his hair, and I just said his name, and I knew who he was because that system was not shut down. And I just smiled. I felt okay. And then I saw things like the traffic. But when it's like that, all you see is this whoosh and shapes and color, and it frightens you. You could just as easy run in front of it. So when he helps me to get breathing, get rhythm going again, get settled into a pattern. Next thing, to put the words back together with what I'm seeing, and the connection gets made. It's like being born, and you're so happy to be back. It's really good. It's really great.
Do you remember what set off that shutdown?
Yes. At that time, it was that I'd walked in I was in an unfamiliar place, and that was okay because I was at least with familiar people, and I either need familiar people or familiar place. If I'm missing the two, I'm very vulnerable to this. But what happened was then someone else came and joined us, and that person, I couldn't instantly communicate with them directly, and it was not deliberate. It was an automatic response to refer to him as he and to address him through the person I was familiar with. And he just got very angry, and he said, "You'll look at me when you're speaking to me. I'm not him, I'm," and he told me his name. And he started giving me a kind of a very fast-talking, act-normal lesson in 5 minutes. And he was speaking so fast, his movements were all unfamiliar, his intonation was all unfamiliar. My emotional reaction was going zoom straight from basic up to five. Everything was hitting at once, and that was it. I started to shake. I couldn't comprehend. And my friend, just who happened to be with me, just said, indicated to me to come on. And I left with him, and he helped me back out of it. But by that time, I'd gone from overload into shutdown.
I think I've asked you the things that I most wanted to ask.
Yes.
And I think you might be tired anyways.
Yes.
You don't sound tired, but you told me before that talking for an hour is a very long time for you. So
put it this way. I just know you said tired, talking for an hour, and long time for you. Is that some indication?
Yes. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Goodbye, Terry.
Donna Williams' new book is called Nobody Nowhere, The Autobiography of an Autistic. On the second part of our show, we'll be joined by Dr. Bernard Rimland, founder of the Autism Research Institute. His son is autistic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.